Weekday mornings at 5 on KPFT.
Due to the following special program, our regularly scheduled programming will not be heard. This is KPFT Houston.
You're listening to KPFT Houston, Texas. This is Houston's community radio station serving our diverse communities for more than 50 years.
For example, sex with an infected person or sharing drug needles with an infected person, and infected mothers can give it to their babies. So quit worrying, or if you need to, do something about it.
Worrying about AIDS won't help stop it. Understanding it will.
Robert Frauder is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Frauder to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state that carries out a third of U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorney Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Linda Schneider, and special guest Dr. Joel Zivit, an anesthesiologist and expert on the effects of the so-called lethal injection drugs, David Schneider, friend and former colleague of Frauder, and Clinton Young, former Texas death row prisoner, now out on bond. The execution watch for Robert Frauder begins.
Hello and welcome to our listeners around the world on this Tuesday, January the 10th edition of Execution Watch, held whenever the state of Texas executes a prisoner. I'm Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for Coming to America with Gordon Kwan on 90.1 FM HD1, they'll be back next week in their 6 o'clock time slot, so join them then, please. Before we start the show tonight, I want to mention that longtime legal analyst for Execution Watch, Michael Gillespie, will not be joining us for tonight's broadcast. Michael, we love you and look forward to you rejoining us here in the studio very, very soon. You know, when Elizabeth Stein and Ray Hill began broadcasting Execution Watch in the summer of 2008, it was the beginning of our use of community media for nearly 15 years to shine a light on the disproportionate use of the death penalty in Texas. Even nationally, the Lone Star State remains an outlier. Few other states still use the death penalty, and new surveys show that support for capital punishment by Americans remains at a near half century low, even amidst the record high perception that local crime has increased. Tonight, we bring you live news coverage as the state of Texas plans to execute 65-year-old Robert Allen Frauder, convicted in the murder-for-hire scheme of his wife, mother of his three children, Farah Frauder, found shot to dead in the couple's garage in 1994. It's a full show tonight. Let's get to it. Joining us, our reporter outside of the death house in Huntsville, is Linda Schneider. Linda, hello. Well, here we are again. It looks like the state of Texas is back in the execution business.
Yes, it looks like it, but Let's hope that Denver freedom
Well, of course, we do have some hope. I mean, you know, there was a hearing in Travis County today concerning allegations by Frada and two other death row inmates regarding the use of expired and substandard drugs in executions of Texas prisoners. Any word on that?
Yes, anyone that was executed before 2019 or after 2019, they all have expired drugs. That's what we brought up to court today. That's not good.
We're going to be talking a little bit later on to Dr. Zivit about what's going on with some of that. And I think that'll be some interesting aspect. Tell me, you know, I mean, and of course, the Supreme Court, there was an emergency petition before the Supreme Court. I believe that's been pushed aside as well. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
So before we get started, tell us a little bit, describe the scene outside of the death house for us.
What's your name?
Edward.
Yes, ma'am. I'm Danny. Pardon me, what did you say?
Can you describe the scene outside of the death house? I hear Danny. I hear a lot of different people out there. Who is out there today?
There's a lot of guys dying today, yes.
But I am listening to
it. He was on my favorite. I don't know what's going to happen.
Definitely about the mayor. Linda,
for those of our listening audience around the world, explain what signal you are looking for to know that the execution is about to begin.
The only thing Jessica is an attorney.
What happened to what's your minister?
Hopefully,
Linda, we can't hear you. If you don't mind, take that other end of your earbud back.
Okay.
And we'll give it to David in a little bit. Can you repeat what you just said? Yeah, thank you.
Okay, all right.
So explain the signal that you're looking for to know the execution is about to begin.
If they cross the line, but nobody's going to cross the line if it's not going through.
And the protesters, the people who are against the death penalty and are trying to stop the execution are on one side of the street, and I assume that there's another location for people who are for the execution.
Yes, we had some trouble a while ago because there were people over here that wanted him dead, and so the guards asked him to go to the other side where they're supposed to be.
So there's a large crowd there compared to usual. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'm going to come back to you, Linda, but tell us about Robert. Do you know him?
Yes, I know him, and I like him. I don't have anything against him. My, husband worked with him and, at the police department, and he knows Robert quite well. He can tell you a lot about Robert, and but I know one thing. Robert never asked him to kill his wife, and that's what a lot of people are saying that he did. And he never asked my husband to do that.
Well, Linda, we're going to be bringing your husband in, David Snyder. We're going to bring him into the conversation in just a little while. But right now, I'm going to come back into the studio, and we're going to talk with our panel, which, of course, joining us to put this case in perspective is our chief legal analyst, Larry B. Douglas, and special guest, Clinton Young, former death row inmate. Larry, how did we get here?
Well, Marlo, you mentioned a few minutes ago that Robert Frada is about 65 years old. This case has been going on for almost 30 years. Going back to 1994 when the murder occurred, Frada, at the time that the murder occurred, Frada and his wife, Farah, were embroiled in a pretty contentious divorce. So for the divorce proceedings, when they got contentious, the divorce had been going on for about 2 years. And so the custody dispute had gotten pretty nasty. And initially, he didn't want child custody. And then he says, I do want custody. And he started to complain to people that, he stayed broke all the time. because he's paying child support and so forth, and that if he were to get custody, then he wouldn't have to pay child support. And Frada is a very talkative person, apparently, because he talked to a lot of people. He, as we've discussed earlier, was a police officer, I think, in Missouri City where he worked. He trained as a public safety officer, which means his training included both police and firefighter. So he became a certified peace officer at the time they got married. They got together, got married, had three children, two older boys and then a girl. The divorce comes to light. The divorce gets contentious. Robert starts to complain. Robert then reportedly talked to a lot of people, asking them, according to some of the witnesses, to kill his wife. Now, he's a police officer, and strangely enough, nobody ever reports it. He was also an avid bodybuilder. He spent a lot of time in the gym, President's First Ladies, and he spent a lot of time working out. And from people there, he's reported to have asked at least 10 people to kill his wife. Purportedly, but nobody reported any of this. Then in 1994, his wife gets killed. Now the trial, he was found guilty in 96. The evidence at that trial came primarily this was a murder for hire, is the way it was reported. That is, one of his gym mates, a person he knew from gym, a guy by the name of Joseph Priestesh, arranged to hire another person, Howard Guidry, to do the killing. So Priestesh and Frada would from time to time talk at the gym. Priestesh then goes to Priestesh's next door neighbor of Priestesh's fiance, girlfriend, Mary Gipp. And Mary Gipp, the testimony that convicted Frada primarily came from Mary Gipp. The two co-defendants, Priestesh and Guidry, are also on death row. So they got a death sentence, and their testimony, they were not witnesses at the trial, but their statements did come in primarily through Mary Gipp. There's lots of testimony regarding the planning of the murder, supposedly, primarily coming from Mary Gipp. So Mary Gipp gave many statements that were given by Priestesh, her boyfriend. They were introduced in the court. They were clearly hearsay statements, but because they were statements against Priestesh's penal interest, then that was an exception to the hearsay rule. That was the exception to the hearsay rule. So the statements did come in. There was another objection to those statements, saying that they did not provide for his right to confront witnesses. Okay, so the confrontation issue was the thing that brought the case back. So he was convicted in 1996. The case got reversed 12, 13 years later, and he's back in court. And he ends up getting convicted again in 2009.
Which county is this?
This is Harris County.
Okay.
Right here in the 230th District Court. I think Belinda Hill was the presiding judge over the court. And the people who were involved in the case are still around today. But the way that the case played out, the way that the evidence introduced at trial seemed to reflect that the plan was made that Priestesh arranged for Guidry to do the murder. Priestesh purportedly was offered some money, I think about $3,000, and a Jeep that Frada was going to provide to him. And Priestesh talked a lot after the case was over, and so did Guidry. They both made several statements which got them indicted and then finally given the death penalty. But the way the whole matter worked is the evidence seemed to show that Frada arranged to have a to take the children, all three, to church on that Wednesday when the murder occurred. So he's got the three children. He takes them to church, to the Catholic church, for the Wednesday meetings at church, Wednesday evening meetings at church. And he then stayed for a parent meeting also. This was deemed to be uncharacteristic of him. And purportedly, during the time that he was at church, he got several phone calls and returned several phone calls and stayed on his pager. While he's at church, the neighbors make a phone call saying, the 911 call reflected that a neighbor says, "I just heard a shot. I saw a woman get shot in her driveway, in her pulling into her garage." Okay, so the 911 call reflects the neighbor says, I heard a shot. I see a woman down. And he shot her again. Okay, I see him standing there. She's talking to the 911 operator and talking to her husband, saying, don't go over there to check on her, because she's on 911 saying that the person who shot him is dressed in all black. And he's hiding behind a tree. Seems like he's waiting for a ride. A ride comes by. That ride picks him up. Those people were identified by Mary Gipp as being her boyfriend, Joseph Prostich, and Howard Guidry. Howard Guidry was the trigger man. Howard Guidry gave a very lengthy statement as to how he did it exactly. Okay. So, but this testimony came in primarily through Mary Gipp. Okay. So Mary Gipp talked to Prostich before he left to do the, what he said later was a killing. She talked to him. She knew what he was going to do. She never reported to anybody. She never tried to stop them. When he came back, she talked to him again. He said it had been accomplished and Guidry had done it. She, concerned for herself, decided he's throwing away some of the spent casings. So she took them out of the trash herself and hid them. She then took the weapon, which was later identified as the murder weapon, and wrote down the serial number. But she never reported that to anybody. And actually, she began to, she kept everything a secret until when the investigation began. It appeared that they were focusing on her, and she then started to sing to get herself out of the trouble that she clearly was in. So the way the incident occurred is that it is reported that Frada timed the matter so that once the killing occurred, then he would show back up at the house. So the being at the church, according to the evidence, she used that as the alibi element of, I was at the church. Everybody saw me. I was there the whole time. So I could not have been the person who committed the offense. So it took them a couple of weeks to put the whole deal together. And then he was arrested. And so then were Prostich and Guidry. He had a trial. There was a lot of other evidence that was used during the trial from the divorce proceedings, because the divorce proceedings, when the custody issue became contentious, there were depositions taken, and one of the things that Farah accused Frada of was having a sexual deviancy. Okay. I'd never even heard of this term, coprophagia, or coprophilia. That there seemed to be a suggestion that her saying that about him, although he said it himself, would be detrimental to his reputation. But that condition as disgusting as it sounds, is where he gets sexual gratification from being defecated in his face and his mouth, or urinated in his face and his mouth by women. And so apparently Farrah had mentioned something about that, that that was one of the characteristics that he exhibited. It was suggested during trial that he wanted to silence her from saying that, although there were many other witnesses who said he told them that himself. But in any event, he was found guilty and sentenced to death in 1996. Then that case was overturned as a result of a violation of the Confrontation Clause. So a person has the right to a trial by jury, the right to have witnesses testify on your behalf, the right to confront and cross-examine your accusers. And when Mary Gipp testified about the things that Prostich and Guidry may have said, those statements were not subject to cross-examination, because all Mary Gipp knew is that they said that. And so there was no way to cross-examine her. And so they were hearsay statements. In determining whether any of those statements come in, the appellate court makes a determination of do they ring true? That is, are there ways of determining their reliability, one of which being that, is there corroborating evidence? Okay, and once the judge makes that determination, if it's found to be not an abuse of discretion, then the statements do come in. Now apparently what happened in 1996 may have been determined to be an abuse of discretion. So when the 2009 case was held, they were careful to make sure that similar statements came in. But the evidence of the corroboration, that is, if Mary Gipp mentioned when the incident occurred and where the incident occurred and so forth, you've got other witnesses. The neighbor across the street, you've got witnesses who came forward and testified regarding fraud having asked them. We thought he was joking. I want you to kill my wife. Okay. Over and over and over again. Okay. Howard Guidry was picked up weeks later in the commission of an aggravated robbery. He had the murder weapon on him. And he reported to the police, well, I got this murder weapon. I got the weapon, which turned out to be the murder weapon, from Joseph Prostich, who got it from Robert Frada. And there's evidence that Frada purchased the weapon. So we're back again. The evidence seems to be overwhelming, at least the evidence adduced at trial both times. And so now we're at the point of deciding whether he dies or not. Now the issue of future dangerousness, police officer, clean record, had no prior criminal history whatsoever, and had been a model inmate while in prison for 13 years between the two cases. So he's never gotten any write-ups whatsoever. And so whether he's going to be a future danger or not is left up to the jury in determining whether there's sufficient mitigating circumstance. Is he going to be a future danger? But the courts have held repeatedly that the instant offense, that is the murder, in this case, murder for hire of Farrah Frada, that in and of itself is sufficient for the jury to conclude that the person is a future danger.
At this point, let's go ahead and just kind of catch everyone up. You are listening to KPFT's Execution Watch, 90.1 FM HD1 here in Houston, Texas. And this is our panel. We're talking to both Larry Douglas and to Clinton Young. Let's bring Clinton in here right now while we are waiting to hear still if the Travis County court will actually rule something on the allegations by Frada and two other death row inmates regarding the use of expired and substandard drugs in executions of Texas prisoners. We are waiting to see if the witnesses cross the road. At this point in time, they have not. We do have our eyewitness, Linda Snyder, there in front of the death house. Let's bring in Clinton. Clinton, did you know Robert? Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, I knew Robert. Like I said, I mean, he wasn't a problem on death row. I mean, he never got in trouble. Most time he just stayed in the law library. I mean, he focused on his case, and that was his big thing. He was always focused on his case. You know, he was always saying he was innocent, that he was at the church and that he didn't do it, and on and on and on. Yeah, he wasn't somebody that would be considered, like, you know, you talk about the jury coming to that determination and they say the facts within itself, the court saying that it's okay to send somebody to death based on the facts. If Frada had a life sentence, he wasn't going to be a threat to nobody in the prison population. I mean, he's just, it seemed like the only person that he was a threat to, according to them, was his ex-wife. Unfortunately, that's all too common in our society. But, I mean, there's, like I say, he's been on death row for, like, was it 28 years now?
Yeah.
26 years or something like that?
Since 96, right?
The only time he really been in trouble was an officer was messing with him one day and told him to come out the cell, and he was stripping out, and they told him to strip out again. And that's a common thing they do until you get frustrated and say, hey, man, I already stripped out, and then they pepper sprayed him. And
tell us what that means, strip out.
Before you leave your cell, you have to get completely naked so they can see that you don't have no weapons or contraband on your body, right? And there was a rank at the time who he would pick and choose which people he did this to. Some people he was cool with, some people he would do this to. And it was unfortunately a problem on Plunsky Unit on 12 Building. And Frada one day, I guess it was just his day, right? Yeah, but he wasn't refusing to come out. I used to get pepper sprayed all the time just to cause problems with the officers. You know, Frada wasn't that type of person. You know, and I mean, that was the only trouble I think of that he ever got there. And that really was not his fault. He was assaulted, basically, by a TDC officer. And so, I mean, there's no, if it's supposed to be served for the worst of the worst, yeah, some of these crimes that people are there for are outrageous, and it might shock the conscience, of course. No murder's pretty. And there's thousands and thousands and thousands of people serving time in prison mm-hmm. for murder. They get out on parole. We don't kill everybody that kills people. And so I just don't see, you know, the benefit of executing him in accordance to what the death penalty is for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because like I said, he's not the worst of the worst.
You know? In your opinion, it's not preventing any...
No, it's not. I mean, it's not. Because, I mean, generally, taking in the nature of the case, and again, I'm not saying the man did it or not, I wasn't there. But domestic violence is an emotional crime. And it's all too common. And so to sit there and say that, oh, we execute people who do this type of thing is not going to stop nobody down the road from doing it. I mean, anybody finding out about this, all they're going to do is like maybe not tell everybody and their brother or post on Facebook, hey, will somebody come kill my wife? You know, I mean, but it's just things like this is just not a deterrent. You know, I mean, because like I said, domestic violence, unfortunately, is an emotional crime.
And in terms of that one infraction, I did see a mention that he did have one write-up, but he appealed it. It was found that he was not at fault, that
the
infraction was overturned.
Okay, well, yeah, okay, there you go. Because, I mean, he was, like I said, he was assaulted. I mean, he was coming out of his cell. He didn't want no trouble. Matter of fact, I was down there on level, and he comes down there, and I'm like, the hell's he doing down here?
Yeah.
And I was down there for hooch or something, right? Something I wasn't supposed to be doing. And he comes down there and he's asking for soap, and the officer's like, well, I can't give you no soap. Well, you're supposed to get something to take the pepper spray off. They just put him in a cell with nothing to let him burn. And I remember he yelled out, you people are evil. And everybody started laughing, right? Because that's like a fraud thing to say, right? But yeah, like I said, that's the only trouble I ever knew he got into down there, and that was just, it wasn't his fault. He was assaulted.
Now, we didn't interview Frada, but he was subject to several interviews, including one day before yesterday.
Absolutely.
And in all of his interviews, he is always cordial and identifies himself as a Christian man and talks about his relationship with God. That gives him the peace that he deserves. But he's still fighting. It's not like it's something he wants to die, but he says he's made his peace.
Well, there was a lot of publicity surrounding Robert Frata's case. I don't know why the interest specifically, but there really has been. And Clinton, do guys on death row who have a lot of publicity surrounding their cases, are they treated differently by the inmates or the staff?
It's just some people choose to get out in the media. Some people don't because of the circumstances of their case or their lawyer's advice. You know, all my lawyers told me to do this and that, and I didn't listen to none of them. You know, I'm like, look, I'm finna do this, so either you're gonna tell me what I need to do this way, or I just go out there on my own, right?
Oh, the perfect client.
Right. Oh, yeah, I argue with a lot of attorneys, but so did Frada. I mean, that was the thing, is it, you know, he got the retrial, and he mentioned that some of the evidence that was used against him, some of the other statements, stuff like that. What's up?
I just want to say it is 6:30.
Oh, okay.
You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM here in Houston, HD1. Thank you for joining us. If you tuned in expecting to hear Coming to America with Gordon Kwan, please check back with them next week. They will be back on the air at 6 o'clock. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. Frada never gave a statement. All right. I mean, is there anything in the record? I don't think he ever confessed or anything. Like from my reading of everything, when I've talked to him in the appeals I've read, like he never confessed to it.
He never confessed.
I mean, yeah, I'm not talking about that.
Just a moment. We're getting reports online. I'm so sorry to interrupt again. That the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has vacated, and the execution will continue on.
Vacated? You mean denied?
Denied.
Okay. We said vacated. I was like,
vacate.
Okay.
My apologies.
Yeah, so like some of the evidence they used, for example, there was supposedly a statement from one of the co-defendants, and that was tossed out because it come to find out that the police had manipulated him into doing this. So a cop actually bragged about it in court, and another lawyer overheard it. So that's really what helped open the door for all of them. Price Dash was unfortunately denied a new trial. I think there was a change of law or something like this, right? But you have this one witness who has all this information, you know, and she doesn't say nothing until she feels like she's going to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm always going to have a problem with that because all they convicted me on was co-defendant testimony.
Right.
And so here it is. They want to take a man's life. And yeah, he talked about, He might have asked these people to do this crime. I think there's a lot of ex-husbands and ex-wives that say, oh, I want to kill my husband or kill my wife, you know. And so I think that's why a lot of people might not have took it serious.
Mm-hmm.
Because when people go through divorce, it gets ugly and people complain.
And so
my thing is, like I said, is that I just don't think that this man should be losing his life tonight. Based on this, and there was already stuff that came out about police misconduct with the co-defendant. You know, they manipulated a guy into the statement, so which was later tossed out, as it should have been. And there's also other stuff that came out in the case that about a vehicle. There was different stuff that the police had that was never turned over to his lawyer.
Right.
And that was some of the things he raised in appeal. Frada, unfortunately, he was very compatible with his attorneys and the way he did it. So he always had a contentious relationship with them. And so he did a lot of things pro se. And the problem with pro se is the courts are never going to let you win pro se. I mean, because they feel like if you do that, then everybody's going to start filing everything themselves. And it'll just, they perceive it to be chaos in the court. And so a lot of things that he filed, tried to file himself, and then we finally got attorneys to do it. He had to deal with procedural bar, And so the bottom line is, here it is, you have the police had other evidence that they just never turned over. You know, they picked and choose, and Harris County Police Department has a very bad history of doing that. There's a lot of guys down there that more, since the new administration's in, more information is being released. And so the police department, you know, they went by their perception of what was exculpatory evidence. Well, I don't need the Fox saying which chicken gets to eat, be ate. You know what I mean? And so all evidence should be turned over, especially if they're going to take somebody's life.
Exactly.
So, I mean, there's a, like I said, I personally feel there's a lot of problems with this case and with the other co-defendants cases because they suffer the same thing of evidence not being turned over, right?
Well, now we've had a little bit of an idea of what Robert was like in jail, mm-hmm. incarcerated, some of the problems that he was doing. Let's go back to David Snyder, if we can, who is outside of the death house right now, and get a little bit of a perspective from someone who was there, who worked with Robert back in the day. Is David Snyder there? David, can you unmute your phone? We're talking with David Snyder. He's a former police officer with the Stafford Police Force, a small bedroom community outside of Houston, for those of you who may not know, where David served as the humane officer. And he became friends with Frada when Frada was with the Missouri City Police Force. The nearby cities shared municipal services at the time. David, how well did you know Robert?
I knew him well as in the day.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of person did you find him to be?
Oh, I thought he was a fine young gentleman. I thought he was a gentleman.
Did you personally have any contact with Robert Frada after he had been convicted?
No. No, I used to visit him when he was in the penitentiary. That's after I retired and everything. I went to see him.
Tell us a little bit about him and how that worked out.
He's got a real fine attitude and good thoughts of everything. I don't know. I feel real proud to mention this, and I think he's a good guy.
Do you think he would have been a threat or present danger if he was not executed this evening?
None at all.
What do you think about all this? Does the state of Texas have it right?
I don't think so.
And David, what would you like to say about Robert Frada?
You know, you understand everything going on here. State of Texas says it takes $7 million to kill the man, but we can send him to life and he could be put on a penitentiary for $10,000 a year.
So following the money.
Now, is that good sense?
Not really. Well, David, thank you so much. We're going to be bringing in some other people to our conversation.
Sure.
I sure do. Thank you. You're welcome to stay on the line and add anything you want. Joining
us. No, ma'am. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Joining us now, too, is Dr. Joel Zivit, an anesthesiologist at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Zivit, thank you for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And now, before we go any further, just a programming note to parents. If you have children nearby, this next segment may contain graphic descriptions not suitable for undeveloped ears. Dr. Zivit, you've conducted over 200 autopsies on prisoners who were executed by lethal injection. Could you please tell us what the drugs do to the body once injected?
Sure. I mean, just to correct you, I have reviewed autopsies. I've not performed the autopsies myself.
Thank you for that correction.
I think that the lethal injection was intended to be a method of execution that would create a state where an individual would seemingly fall off to sleep. And then in that sleep state, they would then shortly thereafter die. and that when one observes a lethal injection execution, there generally may not be much to see. And so for a long time, I think that the impression of what was observed kind of fit with the way that lethal injection was represented to actually cause death. In my work, I was first actually handed a list of autopsies to review for another legal case. And the question I was asked related actually to the blood levels of the drug sodium thiopental, actually, or pentobarbital, which was used for execution. And I was asked whether or not pentobarbital drug levels would comport with the kind of drug level that would cause death. But when I reviewed the autopsies, what I found to my surprise was that not only was pentobarbital, you know, present in varying amounts, but what was striking was the fact that there was significant organ damage of the body that was not really evident by people who were watching the execution. And most significant was what was happening to the lungs. So that the lungs of individuals executed by lethal injection really were severely damaged. The way that this was shown was that in the lungs, which normally would be full of air, their lungs were now filled with fluid, with bloody froth that was actually seen in the lungs. And the only way that this could have happened would have been as a direct consequence of the technique of lethal injection. And I was surprised to find this because, again, it was not obvious to see it when a person watches someone die in this way. That's, I think, what's so sinister about lethal injection as a technique. And I think that the reason why this happens, if I may, my speculation has to do with the fact that the pentobarbital, when it's injected, is actually a very caustic substance. It's in the chemical world, it would be referred to as an alkali solution. So, you know, alkali solutions are things that we use, you know, for cleaning purposes. Things like bleach, for example, are an alkali solution. So what's actually happening here is that pentobarbital in high quantity is like injecting, you know, bleach or something like that directly into the bloodstream. And so it travels to the lungs and really creates a kind of a chemical burn inside of the lungs. There's a delicate tissue that separates the blood and the air, and this tissue breaks down. And so, you know, the blood and kind of froth can now spill into the lungs and fill the lungs and cause the lungs to be saturated with this bloody froth. It happens quite quickly. So instead of falling off to sleep and dying peacefully, you're actually drowning in your own bloody secretions. And when we see inmates coughing, that coughing is likely the beginning, the manifestation of this kind of bloody froth that's now accumulating in the lungs.
Dr. Zivit, in your opinion, do these men and women die in pain?
Well, you know, it's obviously, I think, cuts to the core of the problem here. For the method of execution to be constitutional, it has to not be cruel. And cruelty is a complicated kind of idea. The court, by the way, has decided that there's such a thing as the normal pain of dying, which as a doctor, I'm not really sure what that's supposed to be, because when I deal with patients that are dying, I do everything I can so that death is not painful. But the court seems to recognize something that they call the normal pain of dying. And even if these prisoners are dying in pain, the court does not seem to be moved by that. But is it painful to have fluid in your lungs? Well, imagine as an example, you're drinking a glass of water. And in error, some of that water, instead of going into your esophagus, goes into your trachea. and it goes now into your lungs, you get that immediate sensation of coughing, and it can be quite terrifying if you have this kind of even very mild aspiration event, we would call it. People find that quite uncomfortable. They cough and they sputter because the lungs are really designed specifically only to manage the movement of air. So anything other than air in the lungs is really very, very noxious to people and painful. So to answer your question, is it possible that people who are being executed experience their own death as painful and terrifying? I would have to say yes. I think that that's a real possibility.
You know, back in 2011, this program talked with Maya Foa. She was then the head of Reprieve London's Task Force Stop Lethal Injection Program, or SLIP, as her organization began the campaign to stop European corporations from selling the lethal drug cocktails used in modern executions. It's been 12 years, and although the Europeans have stopped selling the lethal drug cocktails used in modern executions, boutique pharmacies have sprung up here in the U.S. Is there a difference between the chemicals manufactured by companies like Lundbeck of Denmark and the boutique pharmacies in the woodlands outside of Houston?
Well, look, I think that, you know, the problem here, and I think also what's at issue in this particular case, is that lethal injection is designed to impersonate a medical act. And so when you're talking about drug expiration dates, for example, again, that is very much in the, you know, under consideration when these drugs are going to be used as medicine. Now, when the drugs are going to be transformed from medicine into poison, which is what, of course, happens in lethal injection, it's a very different kind of matter. And so the question about whether the drugs have expired or not becomes hard to kind of parse. I think that drug manufacturing, of course, is a highly regulated kind of activity here in the U.S. and in other places. Drug manufacturers are regulated by, you know, for example, the FDA, which has something to say about manufacturing. Now, what you're talking about, these kind of smaller places, so-called compounding pharmacies, are under a different set of regulations, and their standards for production are different. And further, what, of course, they're making is not meant to enter into the, the medical market. So, for example, if a compounding pharmacy is now making pentobarbital for execution, they have no intention of using that same pentobarbital to sell it, say, to a hospital for the purposes of medicine. Now, whether it can accidentally get into the hospital market, that's, I think, a real risk. And so the standards of production of compounding, again, are different. And I think how the state, of course, keeps, you know, these chemicals is going to be different than, say, the way a hospital would keep them or a pharmacy would keep them. But again, the whole point of lethal injection is to give this sense to the public that the same sorts of oversight and careful, you know, consideration of safety, which are used in the practice of medicine and in pharmaceutical industry, are all absent here. This is now just, you know, an impersonation, an illusion, a myth, I think, of safety and of the sort of things, again, that would be important if this was a medical act. And of course, lethal injection is not a medical act.
You know,
can I ask one question?
Absolutely. This is this is Clinton Young, and talking, of course, to Joel Zivit.
Hello, Mr. Zivit.
Hi.
Yeah. I spent 18 and a half years on Texas death row and almost came a week away from my own execution, right? So I took an interest in, the execution drugs. Pentobarbital, does it affect the same receptors as, like, opioids in the brain?
So pentobarbital is a drug in the class called a barbiturate. Okay, so barbiturates work in various parts of the body. I think that what's important in execution is that they, yes, they work in the brain, but they also work in the heart, for example, in the circulation. Okay. Okay. So pentobarbital, I mean, you raise an interesting question about opioids. So opioids, of course, work in the brain, and their job is to cut pain. So if you have pain, you take an opioid. But if you have pain, you would never take a barbiturate. Barbiturates do not take pain away. In fact, they can actually make pain a little worse. So barbiturates work on a different pathway than opioids do. But whereas opioids, again, can take pain away, barbiturates can actually make pain worse.
Now, one last question about the pharmacy. I know that a lot of these compounding pharmacies came under scrutiny. In recent years, there was a case out of Tennessee and another case out of North Carolina where, like, meningitis, there was an outbreak of meningitis because they improperly handled chemicals at these compounding pharmacies. And a lot of people complained about how there was less regulation of them. It was more up to the state versus what you would see, like you said, at a hospital. And TDC says that they take these drugs and they send them off to be tested. So, I mean, I'm no chemist, but I know that when things are exposed to sunlight or the temperature fluctuates, it affects the chemical structure of it, right? So could it be if say these chemicals get warm or get exposed to light, could that start breaking them down?
Well, look, you know, you're right on point there. The story that you raised about it was local anesthetics actually that became contaminated with a peculiar kind of fungus in the cases that you're talking about. So people were injected with chemicals that were meant to treat pain in this case, developed fungus infections, and many people died. So that really was a catastrophe. And it really, I think, shone a light on some of the concerns about the compounding pharmacies. Now, in that case, of course, they were making these drugs for medicine and they weren't meant to be using them for execution. You know, with how the state manages its drug supply, of course, is not in any way a reflection of how a hospital or a pharmacy would manage these things.
Right,
yes,
right.
They are, you know, they have to be, you know, it's a particular kind of thing that has to be stored in a particular kind of way. And if it is exposed to, you know, fluctuations in heat or light or those sorts of things, then yes, the chemical can be altered by the poor handling. These things, of course, are made, you know, to expire after a period of time. But again, expiration in this case really is the language that we use for medicine. You know, what an expired compounding chemical for the purposes of execution means, you know, is it something quite different. The concern, of course, is that, you know, I mean, pentobarbital by itself is already, I think, you know, quite terrible in what it does when it's injected. So what's degraded pentobarbital going to do? Well, I think that's sort of what's at issue here. You know, is the pain that could be experienced here super added to what's already going to happen? You know, the court has already kind of resigned itself in a sense to accept that a certain kind of pain in execution is par for the course. But what's very troubling here, of course, is that now the state seems to be saying, well, we're going to be flexible as to what our upper level of pain, you know, that we can subject prisoners to in the setting of execution. We don't seem to be moved by the risk that we could be causing even more severe and serious pain by what we're doing now.
Hmm. One last thing real quick. You know, the TDC saying that they sent it back to this laboratory to be tested. I mean, if that's the laboratory, the compounding pharmacy they got it from, I don't think it would be in that compounding pharmacy's interest in saying, hey, our stuff is messed up, you know, because they're doing business with the state. And also, you know, having spent 20 years of my life incarcerated by the state of Texas, they can't even get managing the food right. You know, I mean, they can't even avoid not giving us spoiled food. And so I surely wouldn't trust them with medicine or poison either which way, right? I mean,
yeah. I mean, look, I think that, you know, in medicine, you know, in the practice of medicine, sometimes bad things happen. We know this, and that medicine has tried very hard to open its doors, if you will, to the public and invite the public in to see the way that it does what it does, to try to improve, you know, the quality of what it does. And when we have an accident, we have an investigation, you know, that is conducted, and we, you know, we seek to be impartial. You know, we address some of those concerns about being conflicted and evaluating one's own care. I mean, I think probably, you know, other industries do this even better than medicine. So, for example, you know, the National Transportation Safety Board that investigates, you know, airplane crashes, all of that information is all a matter of public record. So that's the way that you create safe systems. So, you know, what's ironic, and I say that in a negative way about Texas and about executions, is that when they do things wrong, when they get into trouble, instead of creating kind of a culture of openness, a culture of accountability, a culture, you know, that invites the public in, they do the opposite. You know, they either pass laws that create secrecy, or it's just declarations of secrecy by state fiat. You know, they just cover it up. So how can the public, you know, be reassured that the state is acting, you know, as a good steward of its own systems of justice? You know, it's this very thing, I think, which shows the state to be, you know, it's a very troubling and disturbing kind of situation.
I agree. And TDC is champions at covering up.
Yeah. Yes. So it would seem.
Well, Dr. Zenit, thank you so much for joining us today. I do have another question. And we use these same kinds of drugs to euthanize animals. Does that mean they die in pain?
Well, I think that, you know, let's be clear that animals are not people. And so the kind of, you know, depending upon the animal, I think that certain animals are much more sensitive, for example, to the effects of a barbiturate, and the quantity of barbiturate that might be needed, you know, is actually quite a lot less. Like, it's the issue here is not that barbiturates don't kill people, because we know that they do. But what the state has always done is said, okay, well, let's find something we think is going to kill people, and then we're going to give 50 times the quantity just to be sure that we're really, really going to kill them. Because the worst thing we could do would be a situation where we don't kill them, or we don't kill them, whatever, fast enough. And so they just give much more of it. And execution, I think, has suffered from this idea that more is better. And so in order to euthanize an animal, you don't need to use that much barbiturate. That's not what's done. If you gave animals the kind of dose of barbiturate that was used in execution, it's very likely that the animal would also have this frothy fluid in the lung. I would expect it would be there as well.
Well, Doctor, thank you so much, Dr. Zivit. We do appreciate it very much, you joining us today. Do you have any questions?
No.
I would just like one ask maybe that I would like Texas to do. It's time for Texas to do autopsies. You know, Texas does not perform autopsies on these inmates, or these prisoners, rather, after they die. And, you know, like other places, if Texas wants to reassure the public that its method of execution is not causing painful and terrible, you know, bloody froth in lungs, then let's do some autopsies and see. You know, I understand that this seems like a somewhat of a, you know, a disturbing kind of ask, but autopsies are helpful here in pointing to the right directions to what exactly is happening. So Texas does not perform autopsies on executed prisoners, and it should.
I think that's something people could raise.
I think that's, you know, a good point.
I mean, it's people could follow suit so that, you know, maybe something can be gained from the execution.
And it makes sense for Texas to do it on its own.
Does.
Just to
nip it in the bud.
Yes.
But yeah, they're not going to do that because they feel like if there's a possibility that it's going to come out, Texas ain't a gambling state. They don't play the odds.
questionable on that. That's true. Dr. Zivit, again, thank you very much. We appreciate your time tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Okay.
You are listening to Execution Watch. We are here waiting still to find out what's happening. Frada is appealing to the Texas Supreme Court, arguing this is a civil matter over which the TCCA has no jurisdiction. And again, that's the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals.
Problem,